We continue now with internationally renowned poet Diane de Prima. The author of 35 books of poetry and prose, Diane knew at age 14 that she wanted to be a poet, and at that tender age made a lifelong commitment. Born in Brooklyn, she now lives in San Francisco, where she works as a writer, healer, and teacher, and studies and practices Tibetan Buddhism. Recent books include Pieces of a Song, Seminary Poems, and a new expanded edition of her epic Loba. She's the latest visiting poet to perform at the Northwest Spoken Word Lab and our guest once again today to talk about her life and her work. We left off talking about what it's like in the society for a strong woman and why we feature or why we fear strong women. And Loba pretty much describes all of that better than we could talk about. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about how Loba came to be. You weren't planning on writing an epic poem.
No, I was not planning on writing an epic poem. I'm not that crazy.
Oh, is that what it takes? It takes craziness?
It takes craziness. It takes you over, in a way.
It takes you over. What do you mean by that?
Well, with especially the first eight parts of Loba, which constitute book one, which was 185 pages, happened over a period of 6 or 7 years, you really never knew when Loba was going to come in. And when it did, that's what you did. You didn't do anything else. I mean, and also took me over in the sense that I wasn't writing other poems. Everything was going into Loba. Now, the book two spread out over a much longer period of time, from 78 to 96, and it's about the same length. And other poems were getting written, and other things were happening. The prose book, for instance, the autobiography that we mentioned, Recollections of My Life as a Woman, was happening. But it takes you over in the sense that it's the main artwork you're doing. And in the characteristic of big artwork is that it uses everything.
It dominates your consciousness.
Yeah, and uses everything you're learning. It uses all your experience. It uses everything you're reading. Everything in your life is going into that one piece.
Wow. Would you be so kind as to read some from that?
Okay, I suppose I could do that. I'm trying to think what would be a useful part to read.
I really like part 7 from the quote and the first couple of pages of that I was reading to the kids. And
the part 7 is the part where, for the first time, the hunt comes in. Is that right?
Yes, I think
begins,
so.
This wolf is black.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, okay, I can read some of that. I think you might find that some of it has some unacceptable radio words in it, though.
Is that right?
The second poem of it. The first poem is fine, I do believe. The first poem is, this is the first time I realized that the hunt was really going to be one of the themes of the poem. I mean, the wolf was there from the beginning. She came in a dream a year before the poem started. And I didn't realize that this dream was related to this poem till I was well into the poem.
Can you describe the dream?
Yeah, the dream is written about in one of these parts, too, a little earlier. I might try to find that. What was happening was I had come back from working in Wyoming. It was the first time I'd worked as a poet in the middle of the country. And in the process of doing that, I always have been an activist. I was an active revolutionary in the West Coast through that time in the 60s. This was 71. And I always thought I knew who the villain was. And when I went to Wyoming, I saw with my own eyes, it was a lot of suffering. There were a lot of abused children, physically terribly abused. And everybody was putting themselves through hell in one way or the other. The homosexuals were putting themselves in the madhouse and things like that were going on. But I saw with my own eyes that there was no solidified villain. And what that did was it confused me and I got sick. And part of the getting better process was this dream in which I met a wolf. About a year after that, the poem began. So at first, I didn't make any direct connection. But by the time I got to part 4 in book 1, book 1 is part 1 to 8, book 2 is part 9 to 16, I found that the dream itself, or part of the dream, got into the poem. So I'll read that. It's called Dream. The Loba reveals herself. She came to hunt me down. Carried down ladder, trussed like game herself, and then set free, the hunted turning hunter. She came through stone labyrinths worn by her steps, came to the awesome thunder and drum of her name, the Loba mantra, echoing through the flat flagstone walls. The mantra is, the footprints, footsteps of the loba, drumming. She came to hunt, but I did not stay to be hunted. Instead would be gone again, silent children in tow. She came, she followed, she did not pursue, but walked patient behind me like some big, rangy dog. She came to hunt. She strode over that worn stone floor, tailgating, only a step or two behind me. I turned to confront, to face her, ring of fur setting off the purity of her head. She who was to have devoured me stood, strong, patient, recognizably goddess, protectress, great mystic beast of European forest, green warrior woman towering, kind watchdog I could leave the children with, mother and sister, myself. So at that moment in that dream, I began to, you know, we have met the enemy and he is us. I began to, and the dream resolved further when I, which I didn't write about, when I went outside. This all took place underground. The house was full of rich people who in the dream were, i.e., villains. We went outside, the wolf, myself, and the children, and all the people from the house who were supposed to be the villains were in a circle doing a magic dance with gestures. And I thought, well, I wanted to go join them. And I thought, no, I can't do that. They're the enemy. And the voice of a friend of mine, my dearest friend who had been dead a few years at that time, said, De Prima, if you think like that, you're going to be sick for the rest of your life. And the dream ended with me joining the circle, me and the children all making the gestures and joining the one dance. And there's a poem about that later in the book. Not about the dream, one of the last poems in part one ends with something like, and if we, and when we have won clear, we must return to the circle. When we have won clear, when we're free of it, we must return to the circle. Return the hunt to the measure of the dance. And it goes on like that.
Now, there's something that ties into this. When you were talking at the roundtable discussion on the poet's role in the community with the Institute for Community Leadership, and there's quite often a sense of us versus them. It's mm-hmm. us doing the good mm-hmm. work of community and who believe in sharing resources, mm-hmm. and there's them. It's either the corporations, the WTO, or whatever else, what have you. And you said that only solidifies the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
Well, I think that what I said was don't solidify the adversary. And when that first came to me as a phrase, it seemed to me like it summed up everything that's smart and good about martial arts. That if you make something solid and real and really reify something you see as evil, then you're stuck. You're locked in a position of fighting. You know, whereas you see the other and whatever else is going on in the world even as process and as flux and change, then you can turn it around and move with it in an Aikido-like manner without standing as square and flat-footed and hacking away at it. Like
turning the energy on itself.
It's just simple, turn it around. Yeah. It wants to turn anyway.
Oh, you see, I can't get the smile like that when you say that. That's the only problem with the radio. The smile that you had after that is beautiful. We're talking with Diane De Prima, internationally renowned poet and author, the author of 35 books of poetry and prose, and an upcoming autobiography as well, which she mentioned. I'm Paul Nelson. Well, that notion of don't solidify the adversary was something that you hadn't quite gotten to when you were writing things like revolutionary letters.
No, although the later ones do. I mean, but no, not in the beginning. And I think that's part of the turning that I was talking about that happened with Loba,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And yet, when you look back at revolutionary letters, you read those in public, people make a request that you read one, you're happy to read that. You look back, in fact, at all your work, and you're not ashamed of any of it.
Mm-mm.
No.
I like it.
Whereas other people, on the other hand, we won't mention any names, looking back at their early work and say, oh, please, let's throw this in the fire. Let's not let it see the light of day. I've come so far since then. But you're comfortable with your old work.
Well, I think you may have come so far since then, but you have to be the advocate and the friend of the person you were. That person you were was, I mean, in a lot of ways, is a lot braver than we are now because I had more to overcome.
That's right. Another thing about Loba and about, I guess, all your work is that very little revisioning, very little editing happens after you commit pen to paper.
Yeah. Often I hear them, you know. I just hear them and I'm just taking dictation. I've been known to take dictation of Loba poems with a kid crawling over me from the back seat or friend talking to me about the boat he just bought, and I'm answering them. It's like my head splits off, and part of it is still with the poem. So a lot of it is dictation. Not always. I don't want to give the impression that I always hear the poem. Sometimes it's a very strong image, but the image might come with a rhythm or with a pattern, or an insistent pattern that wants, and then the words fall into that, stuff like that.
A lot of this change happened as a result, as a direct result of your work with Buddhism, and which you started practicing in the early 1960s.
Yeah, but I think the change started earlier than that. The very early work got revised a lot, and I think it needed to be, not so much for the work, but because I was in the process of learning a craft. And that early work was really more about learning than about the poem, the finished poem. And I was very interested in cutting everything extra away and getting it very stark and very sparse. And then when I knew I could do that, that wasn't interesting anymore. And then I got caught more by the idea of actually following the movement of the mind. Philip Whalen, the beat poet, has the line that in his statement on poetics, that poetry is the graph of the moving mind. And I became very interested in actually the little fluctuations in the tides. It's like wind or tide of consciousness and what goes on in the mind, and catching image that was passing through, but not trying to carry it through to a logical conclusion. You know how when you write your dream down, you want it to make sense and maybe you cheat?
You try and go back to sleep and fix it.
To not cheat when you write, but just follow the... And I did a book called The Calculus of Variation, and that's the main thing in the book. The book had a structure, which was the 8 trigrams of the I Ching, but aside from that, it was just, what was I seeing? So that went on for a while, and after a while, all those things blended. You had the craft. When you study, when you practice cutting and all that, that stays with you. You know how to do that. I wrote a sonnet a day for 30 days when I was a youngster and threw them all out except one, I think. You have those crafts. They're there, so they're available, and then the stuff can just come through you, but it can use everything you've made available. All the poets you've read, all the cadences of other people's work you've got in your head. You don't consciously revise, you don't consciously fix, because the stuff is right there to use, like a jazz musician, maybe.
Yeah, in a sense, it's like part of your repertoire, and you don't have to edit afterwards, because the editing process happens beforehand, in a sense.
It's like listening to Cecil Taylor throw in a little bit of Schoenberg and then go back to what he was doing, you know?
Yeah. That scares people, too, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know if it scares them. Why should it scare them?
It frightens. I mean, jazz music frightens a lot of people, first and foremost. So imagine Cecil Taylor. That's like jazz from another planet. Like Sun Ra. You know, Sun Ra used to say, another planet.
Right.
And I think that was probably accurate. Now, you made a reference to how it's like the ocean, like the tides, but that's more than just a metaphor. I mean, the human, you know, somebody asked Jackson Pollock about nature, and he said, well, I am nature.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what we're talking about here, isn't it? And as a woman, you can tap into that better than the average man, can't you?
Well, I don't know. That's up to you guys. You got to figure that out. I'm not telling you can't do it good. I'm not going to take that trap.
But don't you have a head start?
I don't know.
Isn't nature feminine? Isn't the earth mother?
Well, it was men who made nature feminine. It's in order to have a shadow again. It's something that they could exploit and use up. You know,
and
nature is neither male or female. It's all of it. You know, but the thing of the tides. I think you're onto something there. Sometimes I think tides move in us, so maybe through the whole community or the whole world, so deep, and in such an unpredictable way. You know, it's like, why did you dream that thing at that time? Or why did all these poets write about that kind of stuff right then? And I'm not talking about something they write about because it's in the news. Something. But I think there's these very deep tides that move in us that make even what we call the collective unconscious look superficial. They're so deep. You know, words that the Germans had like Zeitgeist don't begin to touch it, but that feeling of some deep conscious thing that moves. Yeah.
Is there some kind of tide rising up against this this notion of control? This Senate rejects the test ban treaty, this reactionary post-Reagan, we got a Democrat in the White House and we still can't get things done kind of attitude.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm an optimist because I'm an anarchist, and anarchists believe that there's always good at the bottom of human nature. That's why they can be anarchists. I feel like I go places and I see these, like SPLAB, I see these pockets of excitement and energy and new creative energy happening in all these places that I go to. It's an incredible, I read in Las Vegas in a cafe a few weeks ago, it was an incredible gathering of older writers and artists and then some young ones who want to learn from those ones. And I don't know if it's going to be a tide, but I feel like something is starting to percolate through this mud that we've created over the last 20 years of blah.
Ironic that we had tanks out the window yesterday during the workshop.
Well, I thought that was very interesting. You know, Tibetan Buddhism talks about co-emergence, that together with your basic wisdom, at the same moment with it arises your basic ignorance. And it's just a question of which direction you put your focus. But they arise co-emergent all the time, just like what we call the relative world or the world of everyday glop and the absolute world of pristine awareness. They rise together. They rise together every second. You can't say this one's good, that one's bad. So I thought the tanks and things were a great opportunity, too, in a way.
Yeah. I should mention that there was the annual Veterans Day Parade going on, that Auburn has the largest Veterans Day Parade in the state of Washington. And they just have a display almost every year right in front of our building. And it just so happened that our visiting poet came on that particular Saturday. So it was quite interesting. Your autobiography, at least the first part of it, is to be published.
I want to say just one thing about that, which is that as poets, it's important to really accept that we can't edit reality. We can transform it, we can play with it, but that we shouldn't have tried, we don't want to try to edit out the tanks.
Nor,
those are good people out there.
That's the point. We had one person from the workshop say to another person, there they are, there's the enemy, those guys, those baby killers or whatever.
Yeah,
and the person pointed out, you
sweet
know,
sweet young people out there.
those are the same guys who are, you know, in fact, Brian Love, our mm-hmm. Doctor here who runs the controls mm-hmm. and makes this place mm-hmm. happen. Really, he's the main guy mm-hmm. here. I'm just the front guy. He was saying those are the same guys who go out with the sandbags when it floods. Those are the same guys
right.
setting up the Red Cross tents.
Right,
it's just a matter of what programming do we put into them.
Right. And half of them, if we hadn't approached them right, would have come in and written a letter poem.
They probably would have, and they would have cherished that, some of them, for the mm-hmm. rest of their lives, I
yeah.
bet. Yeah. Your autobiography, at least the first part of it, from the first, we hope, from the first quarter of your life, is finished. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, it's called Recollections of My Life as a Woman. Viking is publishing it. I really began it as I thought it was going to be a little short book for my daughters about my various experiences where, and I thought it might be, maybe I could make it funny because so much feminism was gloomy in those days back in the 80s. By various experiences where I bought into some myth of how you should be as a woman, all those shoulds, and did something stupid. But it became a much bigger book than that. And the first part of it, the first eight chapters or so, are about my life as a little person, as an Italian-American during World War II. And it moves on through the first volume, which is at Viking, goes through 1965 and talks about my founding of the Poets Press, the New York Poets Theater, my love affair with Amiri Baraka, my having of my first, I think, three of my five children. I have five children. And all the various things. And a lot of it is also these little issues of what you come up against as a woman artist and how that's played out or how that's misread. But not a lot. I don't believe in having a lot of bitterness about it. You know, me and Amiri, for instance, both edited The Floating Bear, our literary newsletter. I typed. I never saw him type, you know. But that's just how that time was. And I think to blame people for the way a whole time was or a whole culture was is sometimes we get trapped in a big mistake there. But I did write about all that. So it goes from my grandparents' house all the way to my leaving New York and stopping. I came back a few times, but after that was a real active influence in theaters and presses and readings and making all that stuff happen. So it ends in 1965.
The The last interview is just about over here. The state of poetry, as we end the century, probably better than we might have expected back 50 years ago, do you think?
Yeah, I think much better than we would have expected. I have no idea what's really going on. I don't think anybody does, because so many kinds of poetry happening in so many kinds of ways. You have to include rap. You can't turn your back on that. All the oral stuff. You have to look at language poetry. You have to look at the academics. You have to look at the neo-beats. You have to look at what's left of us old guys. And so many other things that we can't even dream of that are just coming up. So, you know, as I said to the girls at the school, Pound said to me, no one ever much use as critic of younger generation. And he was talking about himself refusing to criticize my work. No one ever much use as critic of younger generation. I think it's just blossoming, you know, and we're very, very good at saying this is a weed and this is a flower, and I think maybe we have to remember that all the weeds are there because the insects and the birds need them.
David Masumoto was on the program. He's an organic peach farmer, and he said when he discovered that his weeds were not weeds, they disappeared overnight, they became indigenous growth.
Oh, yeah, and also some of them are wonderful herbs.
Yeah. Be careful what a weed is, and the same thing with people. Be careful who you dispose of, because they might have the greatest gifts of all.
And for the great work to happen, everybody, in writing, everybody's got to be writing. In Shakespeare's time, everybody wrote a sonnet. Every man on the street could turn a song of some sort. We need the base of everybody making art, and it's not up to us to say which part of it is great.
Yeah. Well, I can say that your work is great, and it's been an honor to have you. It's been just a delightful weekend.
Thank you so much. I've had a wonderful weekend, too.
Continued success and health and happiness.
Thank you. And I hope work here flourishes. I'm sure it will.
Thank you. Diane DePrima has been our guest. And, well, as I said, it's just been a delight. If you'd like more information on her work, you can check out our website at inpeoria.org. That's I-N-P-E-O-R-I-A.org.